Welcome back to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. We received word here this morning that the city of Lansing has named a new attorney, and the press release that we received from the office of Mayor Virge Brunero points out Jim Smirtka previously served under Mayors Dave Hollister and Tony Benavides. A quote here from the press release: Joe Abood has done a terrific job as interim city attorney, and I'm grateful he'll stay on my team as chief deputy. But when you have the chance to get one of the top municipal attorneys in Michigan, if not the country, who comes with deep institutional knowledge about Lansing city government, it's an opportunity I just couldn't pass up. Jim Smirtka, the incoming city attorney for the city of Lansing. I'm Mark Bayshore. It is Monday, the 13th of the month. The Flint water crisis has reminded millions more people around the world of the danger of lead exposure. A coalition of groups working to make more Michigan homes lead safe is criticizing state lawmakers for not budgeting more money toward the effort. Our next guests say that the bill, the budget bill, awaiting Governor Rick Snyder's signature, includes about a quarter of what it should have in the budget for that purpose. They are both members of MyAlch, the Michigan Alliance for Lead Safe Homes. Tina Reynolds, Health Policy Director for the Michigan Environmental Council, joins me in Studio S. Welcome, Tina.
Thank you. Good morning.
And on the phone, Paul Hahn is Executive Director of the Healthy Homes Coalition of West Michigan. He joins us from Grand Rapids. Hi, Paul.
Thanks for having me. Hello.
Tina, we'll make clear there is $1.75 million available for lead abatement programs run by the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. That's the figure that's in the budget that Governor Snyder's expected to sign. That's the same sum that was in the current budget, but both of you feel that the legislature missed an opportunity here. Tell us more about this missed opportunity.
Absolutely. The $1.75 million is general fund dollars. So those are our general fund purpose tax dollars. So the legislature can spend that how they see fit. The $1.75 million is continuation funding. And so we're very happy to be able to have that money. It will make around 100 homes lead safe for families in Michigan. But we have over 5,000 kids that are poisoned. So it's really a drop in the bucket to helping families make their homes lead safe. We feel that it's a missed opportunity because with Michigan in the news, I would say virtually every day, multiple times a day about lead and get your child tested for lead and it's time to make your homes lead safe, check your water source. I mean, we have the awareness of the public right now and they're doing just that. They're calling the state for help. We want to make sure that the resources are there.
Paul, your coalition, MyAlch, says that the earmark should be around four times that big, maybe $6.75 million or so. Talk to us about what do you think makes the need so much higher?
Well, we just have a significant number of older houses in Michigan, and we're investing quite a bit in testing children. We're investing quite a bit in helping children who have been lead poisoned. But if we truly want to get out in front of this problem, we have to go after these environmental sources. Across the state of Michigan, we estimate there's almost 1.5 million housing units that have lead hazards in them. We've got to start chipping away at those. Doing it 100 units at a time is a very slow road to get there, and we need to accelerate our efforts if we want to solve this problem within the next generation.
Tina, you pointed out that 1.75 is enough to remediate about 100 Michigan homes.
Yes.
Now, but explain for us here, that assumes a home that is desperately in need of remediation, or is that the average Michigan home?
I would say it's the average Michigan home.
Really?
Yeah. So lead paint was a durable paint. It was one that lasted through a lot of wear and tear. And so where you would find lead paint in a house would be porches, it would be windowsills, it would be doors, really expensive items to replace and repair. And so if you have to replace windows in an entire home, anyone that's done that, even replacement windows is pretty expensive and it adds up quickly. Some homes, older historic homes are very large as well. So if you drive through some Detroit neighborhoods, some Grand Rapids neighborhoods, I mean, they had very large homes.
Paul, you check homes for lead. This would suggest that you go through a lot of older homes and see a lot of old lead paint and the like. Is that the case?
That's certainly the case. Tina hit the nail on the head. Particularly here in Grand Rapids, we see an awful lot of older homes with older windows, and that's almost a universal hazard in these pre-1978 homes. They have lead-based paint on those windows, and that becomes a route of exposure to these kids. And as Tina mentioned, you know, at a $500 or so an opening to replace a window, this is a costly proposition, but the payoff is invaluable.
Our guests are Paul Hahn and Tina Reynolds. Both feel Michigan needs to spend more on making homes lead safe. Paul is executive director of the Healthy Homes Coalition of West Michigan. Tina is health policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. You do the math. You're saying it takes $175,000 on average to make a lead-poisoned Michigan home lead safe. That's more money than many, many homes in Michigan are worth.
Well, an average apartment spends around $10,000 a home. And homeowners do chip in what they're able to, either in sweat equity or church donations. And so, you know, there's a little bit given back for each home that's made lead safe. It's definitely something that we have to do and make a priority. And not every family will need to take advantage of the state dollars. There are families that have resources that are able to make these repairs themselves. And so this is an income eligibility. And so these folks just don't have the dollars to make their homes lead safe. And in most cases, there's a child that's poisoned. Their child is poisoned in their home. So the state is great stewards of these dollars. We stretch every dollar. You know, we've partnered with Wallside Windows in the past to donate windows. You know, so we make the best of the resources that we have. I have full confidence that if the state had those dollars, that we would get a lot of homes done.
You both, I take it, attended and testified at budget hearings. Was this $6.75 million figure, did you explicitly advocate for that figure, Tina?
We absolutely did. Paul and I both testified before the House and the Senate, the subcommittees on budget. We gave them the $6.75 million figure and the basis of that figure. In 2014, we had about 679 Michigan children poisoned above level 10. And level 5 to 9 is a threshold level to determine that a child's been exposed and lead poisoned. So if you're a child that's level 10 or above, you're highly poisoned. These are the worst kids in the state. And so if we have 679 kids level 10 and above, we thought as a good starting point, let's at least meet the needs of the kids that need it the most. And so that would be the $6.75 million.
Paul, how interested, how receptive were legislators when you made these appearances at the Capitol?
Well, I think there was a lot of attention to the issue and a lot of really good questions. And I think an eagerness to learn and try to figure out what to do. I think the challenge is, in the end, we were stacked up against a number of other pressing budget needs, and at this point in time, we're discouraged that lead did not move any further.
Generally, Tina, would you say Michigan residents, Michigan homeowners, broadly, do they feel a sense of urgency about lead in homes, or... has Flint done anything to that awareness? Or would you say it's kind of an out of sight, out of mind kind of thing? It's a house they may well have lived in for many, many years. They just, after a while, you just tend not to think about it. Where is awareness right now, I guess?
I would say awareness is off the charts, and that's one of the reasons we feel that it's a missed opportunity. I mean, in the past, we've had to educate homeowners. Lead poisoning is the silent epidemic. Unless your child is tested, most likely you don't even know they've been exposed. And so it's been challenging to educate homeowners. Close to 70% of Michigan housing stock could have lead paint. And so this is a widespread issue. But with Flint being in the news, we're hearing about water sources. We're hearing about lead outside. We're hearing about lead in soil, lead in paint. There's a phenomenal interest. Families are very concerned. They're asking pediatricians to have their children tested. They're much more proactive. And I think we need to build on that.
Paul, you're inside homeowners' homes. Do you agree with Tina? Did the Flint situation, did the Flint crisis really change the landscape?
Certainly, people are significantly more aware, and you know, in many communities, the word's gotten out that while in Flint it was the water across the state, it is the paint and it's the soil. It's various sources that are getting at kids, and that, you know, the situation in Flint, while it's unique in the fact that the delivery system was the water. It's not unique in the fact that there are 5, even 10% in some communities of kids being exposed to pain still. And that's, you know, that's 1 out of 20, 1 out of 10 kids. And people widely agree, particularly parents, that's a hazard we don't want to put our kids in the way of.
May's state revenue projection dropped here. It wasn't even that long ago. And now they've put together a budget here, including that lower projection. Was that a factor here, Tina?
That's our understanding. We're in the process of scheduling debrief meetings with our policymakers to find out if there's something we could do different, if there's a supplemental, an opportunity in the future to continue to build abatement funds. But yeah, there was close to $400 million that they needed to take out of the budget, and some tough decisions had to be made. I mean, we would definitely argue that keeping lead abatement dollars, continuation funding was not the right decision.
You've got a lot of experience at the Capitol, Tina. I know that. Do you think that number will get bumped higher in the near future? Well, here, let me ask another question first. Had the revenue projection stayed the same, would you have expected a bump in funding?
Absolutely. And Paul alluded to the good conversations that we had with policymakers around lead funding. Every March, we have a Lead Education Day. This year, we met with 50 lawmakers, both in the House and the Senate, Republicans and Democrats. We got a very warm reception. Everyone seemed very committed, very interested in lead funding, wanted to stop our kids from being lead poisoned. So we have a lot of knowledge and education awareness around this issue. I do think it was a dollars and cents determination in the end, and we need to keep working forward.
Paul, you're the guy on the ground in this effort in West Michigan. Talk to us about how the money assigned to the lead remediation program at the Health and Human Services, how do those dollars actually get spent? What do you see those dollars going toward?
Well, the department prioritizes the houses where there are children living that have been exposed. So first of all, you know, finding those lead poisoned kids, unfortunately, you know, the kids are being used as the lead detector here, but going in and making those homes safe, and where there's not a lead poisoned child, if there's not a waiting list there, they will also go into certain high-risk communities where there's just this uber high prevalence of kids being exposed. As Tina mentioned, there is some copay. This program is for low and moderate income households. It's not for the wealthy. So we're really making sure to get this money to those who most need it. And if you think about it, once we fix that home, make it lead safe, that fix is good for decades to come. And so it will protect that child, hopefully help that child heal, but will also protect future kids in that home.
In West Michigan, Paul, where are you most likely to find dangerous levels of lead?
Older housing anywhere, but we see the, you know, across the population, the high prevalence in some of the older central city neighborhoods here in Grand Rapids, Muskegon Heights, Benton Harbor. So it's older neighborhoods where the housing might be distressed from past disinvestment.
But I've heard, for example, I mean, lead-based paint obviously is a concern, but I've also heard that we did a segment on this involving Flint not too long ago, mm-hmm. where you're apt to find lead in dust in the soil, places like that. That's kind of how I meant the question. Where geographically are you apt to find lead?
Well, the geography is
not
linked.
You gave me the geography. I beg your pardon. Yep. But is it soil? Is it in the house itself? Where?
It's our contention that most of it's coming from the degrading lead-based paint. There is also soil contamination from years and years of leaded gasoline use. If you think about how that particulate, the lead particulate from the gasoline, would wash out in our urban environments, it would fall with rain, and particularly on rooftops. And that ends up, you know, in the drip line around the home. So between the paint sloughing off the house and the leaded gas washing out of the air with the rain onto rooftops, that soil around houses is oftentimes very toxic as well. So we're really watching that lead-based paint and then that soil right around the house.
As it turns out, on Friday, Governor Snyder announced appointments to the new Child Lead Poisoning Elimination Board, which was created by an executive order to develop a statewide strategy to help prevent childhood lead exposure. How important is this development, is this formation, Tina?
I'd say it's really, really important. We were very happy to see the new board's charge. It's very forward-thinking. They're looking at prevention. They're looking at testing kids. They're looking at making homes lead safe, services to kids who have been poisoned. But ideally, we want to make sure children aren't poisoned in the first place. And so their charge is very broad, very far-reaching. You know, I've looked at the appointments to the board, including Paul, who's on the phone with us. There's just top-notch folks, people that have been working in this field for years, have great perspective. I'm very hopeful for this commission.
It's a 12-member board, I'll point out, which includes Lieutenant Governor Brian Calley as chair, 7 gubernatorial appointees, and 4 State Department directors or their designees, including DEQ, DHHS, the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, LARA, and the Michigan State Housing Development Authority, MISHDA. This has been very informative. We want to thank our guests, Tina Reynolds and Paul Hahn. Tina is Health Policy Director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Paul Hahn is Executive Director of the Healthy Homes Coalition of West Michigan, on the line from Grand Rapids. Thanks and good luck to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.
Coming up on Current State, since February, the East Lansing Financial Health Review Team has been scouring the city's ledgers to find ways to pay its obligations, mainly pensions and retiree health benefits. We'll talk with team member Eric Scorsone and East Lansing City Manager George Lahanas about how the city is managing its finances. That's on the way. Most libraries encourage young people to read books during their summer breaks, but most libraries don't do it as well as the Livonia Public Library. Every year, its staff makes a video to promote their summer reading program in the community, and this year's video was so good it got some unexpected attention. It was discovered by none other than CBS's Late Late Show host James Corden. He showed clips from the video and made jokes about it on his show. And since then, the video has received over 30,000 views and has been watched all around the world. To find out what makes it so special, we welcome Livonia Library Director Toni Laporte, who also stars in the video herself. She joins us now by phone. Hi, Toni. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
This video has been getting so much attention, but let's walk through it for people who haven't seen it yet. Tell us how it begins.
Well, the video itself begins at the children's reference desk. Adult services librarian Carl is sitting at the desk, and a young boy walks up to him and says, excuse me, summer vacation's starting soon, and I need, and Carl immediately interrupts him and says, you need book recommendations. And that's when the fun begins. Carl's stunt double, one of the Phoenix Free Running Academy performers, jumps on the desk, jumps over the desk, and starts running looking for books. And a lot of other people run out of the back room, flipping and jumping. And then the video pans across the Livonia City campus to the City Hall. They show a picture of the mayor sitting at a conference table, and I'm sitting across from him. He tells me I'm his favorite librarian, and I get a phone call on my cell. So I pick up the cell phone, I hear book recommendation, I throw down the phone, and I run out. The next shot you see is my stunt double on the roof, flipping and jumping and climbing, and then you see me, kind of, jumping off the roof and screaming, and you see my feet flailing and going down, and then all of a sudden I hit the ground and I pop up. And it's actually the stunt double standing behind me on a wall. He jumps down and I jump up. So it kind of looks like it's actually me.
Very, very funny stuff.
It is great.
And it's a library staff never looked quite so fearsome as the Livonia library staff in this video. Before we continue, let's listen to what James Corden had to say when he talked about it recently on the Late Late Show.
But if technology is stressing you out, maybe it's time to put down your phones and pick up a book, which is why a library in Michigan created a video to try and encourage kids to read more over their summer break. And personally, I think they nailed it. Take a look.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, so summer vacation is starting soon and...
You need book recommendations.
There's some parkour that takes place in the video. Explain for our listeners who don't know about parkour what it is and what they see.
Well, I didn't know what parkour was either when I first heard about this video. It's actually, you see it a lot in movies. There are like stunt people who run up buildings and jump over buildings and jump off of cliffs and things. Yet they do it, you know, safely. And they teach you how to do it at the Phoenix Free Running Academy here in Livonia.
It's kind of the paleo diet equivalent of the workout. You read about the paleo diet. It's back to basics. It's like people doing all kinds of extraordinary jumps and leaps around kind of the natural landscape, I think. And your mayor, Dennis Wright, was even in this. What part does he play again?
I'm sitting with him at a conference table when I get the call that I have to come over to the library and help find some book recommendations. He did a great job. His facial expressions were spot on.
Priceless. We like to see the mayor having fun, don't we?
Oh, he's a great mayor, and he loves to have fun.
I'm speaking with Livonia Public Library Director Tony Laporte about the video the library made to promote its summer reading program. Its humor and parkour stunts caught the attention of Late Late Show host James Corden and has been watched by people all over the world. Now, the video is actually 7 minutes long. How does it end? Does the boy get a book recommendation?
He gets a lot of books. The parkour people are running and putting books on the desk, flipping over the desk. And when all is said and done, the original librarian comes back, you know, with a book. And the boy said, well, what I really wanted to know about was the summer reading program. So,
where did this idea get started?
Karen Smith, our head of adult services, went to a performer showcase, and she booked a bunch of acts because we do a different show every week for the kids. And one of them was the Phoenix Free Runners. And when she told Julie Novak, the librarian who writes these scripts, Julie immediately said, that's our video. So she wrote a script, sent it to Paul Sutherland at Livonia TV, and he added a few things, and that's how it got started.
And how did the parkour group get involved?
Well, Julie called them and said, you know, would you like to be in our summer reading promo? And they said, sure, we'd love to. So they did it all for free. They just were great sports. And if it weren't for them, we wouldn't have a viral video seen all over the world and across the country. I mean, Merton College Library at Oxford in the U.K. has shared our video.
Oh, my.
Yeah, well, Israel. It's just crazy.
Everywhere. James Corden did make a comment here about the section of the video in which it looked like you jumped off the building. Let's listen to what James had to say.
Mean to nitpick, right? But I'm just going to say, I don't think that librarian actually jumped off that roof. I can just see some kid in the hospital after jumping off his roof going, I did it because I wanted to be cool. You know, like a librarian.
When did you find out James Corden had discovered the video? And what was it like hearing, hey, it was on national television?
It was surreal. It was an out-of-body kind of experience for me.
Yeah.
I still can't believe it. One of the guys, Paul, from Livonia TV, came over and said, I have a real big surprise for you, and he put it on my computer, and I was just in shock.
Well, the bottom line, I guess, is what it's done for enrollment in this summer's reading program. Has it had the desired effect?
Oh, indeed. Our kickoff was not this past Saturday, but the week before. And after 4 days, we already had over 300 kids signed up. And that is a lot of children.
That's above average.
Yes,
is that it?
Quite.
Okay. Well, I guess it's done its job.
Yes.
You set the bar pretty high. I don't know how you're going to top it next year. You got
the pressure
to come back next year with something really special.
I'm thinking jetpacks might be the next
one. Okay. Or drones or something like that.
Right.
I've been speaking with Tony LaPorte, Livonia Public Library Director, about its now famous video about their summer reading program. Tony, thanks for joining us. Best of luck with the summer reading program.
Thank you so much, Mark. You have a great day.
And coming up on Current State, Mr. Hockey has left us. We chat with current sports host Al Martin later this hour on the life and death of Gordie Howe, universally known as the greatest Detroit Red Wings hockey player ever. Also, Al recaps the Muhammad Ali processional and burial in Louisville on Friday. Also, we'll get an update on the MLB draft, in which a few Spartans made their pro dreams come true. That and more after the break on Current State. Michigan students, public school students, and teachers are about ready to call it a year if they haven't already. And it turns out state officials are urging teachers not to dispose of classroom pets and plants by releasing them into the wild. Some animals and plants commonly kept in Michigan classrooms are considered invasive species in our state. So the DNR is reminding everybody that there are proper ways. Don't release live animals into the wild. They recommend giving them to a hobbyist or an environmental learning center, maybe an aquarium or maybe a zoo. Plants should not be sealed in plastic bags and put in trash, not composted. Okay, so it's that time of year when state officials are reminding classroom teachers about that. The city of East Lansing is under financial pressure. Decreases in state revenue sharing and falling property values triggered by the Great Recession are straining the city's coffers. East Lansing's obliged to pay pension and health benefits to its retirees, but it also wants to rebuild its aging infrastructure. In February, the city commissioned an 11-member panel to scour its ledgers to find the most effective ways to pay its debts and build for the future. The East Lansing Financial Health Review Team will make its first public presentation this Wednesday evening at the Hanna Community Center in East Lansing. Joining me to talk about the team's start, Dr. Eric Scorsone. He's the director of the MSU Extension Center for Local Government Finance and Policy. Welcome back.
Hi, Mark.
And also rejoining us, George Lahana, city manager for the city of East Lansing. Hi, George.
Good morning.
The last time we talked about the financial health review team for East Lansing was in late February. We had Mayor Mark Meadows on the program along with team chairman Mike Moquin. They were just getting organized, and you were just about to have, I think, your first official meeting about that time. Can you bring us up to speed on the progress you've made since then? Is the effort off to a good start, Eric?
Yeah, I think we've had a very good start. We're doing a lot of different subcommittees working on legacy costs, revenues, communications. You talked about the meeting we're having this week. So I think it's off to a very good start. We've had a lot of research, investigations, presentations, and I think the groups come together very well.
George, what's your take on this? It appears that the legacy cost is really what's driving the formation of this. Is it fair to conclude that?
I think that's one of the preeminent problems we faced, and that's why council asked for a report from the commission, this task force, in July of this year, where the full report will come not until December. So I think they recognize legacy cost issues are the most burning issue for the city, and they consequently want a quicker report from the commission.
How much do those legacy costs amount to?
We just got a new actuarial valuation for MERS this past week, and we have about $80 million underfunded for pension, and the number is probably between $35 and $40 million for health care.
So $115, $120 altogether. Mayor Mark Meadows told us the city's in a position where it needs to search for more revenue using existing sources. George, you oversee day-to-day operations here in East Lansing. What's meant exactly by existing resources?
Well, you know, there's only a certain number of tools in the toolbox that we're allowed to avail ourselves. So our property taxes is the biggest one that we're able to use, and that's obviously been constrained by the state in a number of areas, and you sort of don't add that much land, and the city doesn't get bigger, and there's not always growth in terms of new buildings. So that's, you know, that hopefully provides reasonable growth for you, but that's about 50% of our revenue. About 20% of the revenue comes from state in terms of state share revenue, and that's been constrained and cut back since 2001. And the rest is going to be in the smaller areas of fees and fines and all of that sort of thing. So the city really is limited. One of the areas that council could look at is a Headley override, which would allow us to tax further our property taxes. Other areas might be looking at an income tax. Cities are allowed to pass income taxes, and the financial health team asked for a study on that issue. Other areas could be bonding, selling bonds for infrastructure improvements and that sort of a thing as well. So there are a number of different areas, but we are sort of limited in what we can do.
Eric Scorsone, remind our listeners what's involved in a Headley override and what that landscape is all about.
There have been a few of those votes around the state. I mean, basically, the state law requires cities to lower their millage rates over time due to it's a very complex process. But basically, a Headley override is to go back to the original level. And so we've seen a few of those successful in some jurisdictions. It's one of the tools you have. It's really coming out of Proposal A about 20 years ago.
What kinds of things, Eric, from your point of view, can be done with these existing resources? Property taxes, revenue sharing, fees, and fines. How much can those be altered or changed in some way to improve this situation?
I mean, there's always a little bit of room for improvement, but probably not a huge amount. Fees, and, you know, you can maybe have a few new fees, property taxes, you can, you know, do a Headley override or some things like that. You can get maybe some new growth. But, you know, state revenue sharing is what the legislature decides it's going to be, which, you know, probably will be a minimal growth. So realistically, it's going to be, you know, 1 or 2% growth over time. There really isn't going to be a huge amount.
George, Mark Meadows on the program gave an example of the fees that the city charges for rental housing inspections. Do you share that as an opportunity here? Is the city recovering all of the revenue that it's due to that program?
Yeah, I think that's a good example. I mean, typically cities don't make money, and we don't look to make money. You look to recover costs for services provided. So those costs could be, somewhat significant in that area because you have staff who do inspections, you have offices, you have computers and staff who supervise. But really, it's about cost recovery. So those aren't profit centers. We don't get to make money from those, and we're not supposed to make money. We're just supposed to cover costs. So,
but you're not covering the costs. Is that seemed to be the mayor's concern?
I think we've actually had a study by a company to come in and look at our direct and indirect cost recovery, and I think that with some minor tweaks, we're largely where we should be in terms of cost recovery. I would say that we're probably not very far off. But something like that would be, as Dr. Scorsone mentioned, that would be very small modifications on the fringe. It wouldn't really change our fortunes.
We're talking about the financial status of the city of East Lansing and strategies for meeting its long-term obligations primarily. My guest today, George Lahanas, city manager for East Lansing, and Dr. Eric Scorsone, a member of the city's a financial health review team. He's also the director of the MSU Extension Center for Local Government Finance and Policy. Let's face it, East Lansing is known for its services, a diverse array of services. Talk to us about juggling what a lot of residents might consider an essential service versus, that's nice, but maybe we need to take a second look at that. George?
Well, those are certainly tough questions, and that's something that council has to consider, and that's what they're elected to do, is consider the range of services we offer. Since 2001, when the city first started experiencing state share revenue declines, the city has been scaling back staff since that point. About 15 years later, we're about probably about 100 full-time employees, smaller than we were before, and that's just been because we've had to put more money aside for other things, for pension payments and for infrastructure. So we've shrunk the city and therefore likely have shrunk in some ways services in all of our departments. We have less police officers, less firefighters on the street, less inspectors. All of those positions have been constrained. But what we hope is that we've done as minimal an impact as possible on our residents so that they wouldn't notice a difference largely. Mm-hmm. So for instance, in yard waste pickup, we used to have 3 yard waste pickups in the fall that are free. Now we've gone down to 2 after a number of years because we simply had fewer and fewer employees that were there to provide the service.
Mm-hmm.
So there are services we provide that people really rely on and don't want you to cut. You think fire, police, EMS, these services that are life-saving. But even those have been constrained and been reduced in moderate ways. Hopefully that hasn't really impacted our residents. They still think that and believe that they're getting high-quality services, hopefully.
Your team's established an e-town hall online to solicit feedback. I'd like to read, hopefully, a couple of comments here gathered on the site so far. Most of these remarks have been made anonymously. You heard from a person concerned about housing values. They're worried about the growth of rental units and new housing north of East Lansing. He or she writes, consider, please, what these rental units will ultimately do to housing values for existing homesteads as well as existing commercial investments. Supply and demand rules the real estate market, and allowing developers to keep adding to the available housing stock at the recent rate can only result eventually in an overload and subsequent devaluation of homesteads in the older neighborhoods. Would we really like some ghettos? So they're getting at an ongoing devaluation of home prices, and I guess what they fear would be further reductions in tax revenue as a result of that. How relevant is that on this landscape, Eric Scorsone?
Well, I mean, I understand the point. I think, though, you know, for us, I mean, we're not necessarily looking at that issue directly, but I would just say, having looked at other cities in Michigan, that yes, I mean, rental properties are part of the landscape now, though. We're seeing a different kind of consumer of housing today in the U.S. So I'm not sure I'm convinced that the evidence would suggest that there's going to be a decline in housing values because of rental. I think it's part of a housing makeup that a city like East Lansing is going to have because of all the types of residents and college students and so forth. So, and actually right now, I think the real estate market is fairly healthy in this region. So I guess I'm not sure how to address that exactly, but I'm not sure that there's a lot of concerns about all the rental housing, and I understand that, but I don't know if I'm going to say it's going to make a decline in the housing market, in housing values per se.
Mm. George, any thoughts, further thoughts on that?
You know, I think East Lansing, there always seem to be developers who are interested in investing money and providing student housing. I think that East Lansing is well situated because obviously we're the closest in primarily to Michigan State University. So as long as people are willing to invest, it's kind of hard to tell them not to invest and not to construct new buildings or new housing options for people. If the consumer wants new options, they're gonna go there and buy them and rent them. And there may, in fact, be some rental rate falling off in the outlying areas. But I mean, that's just the market doing its work, and you know, it's kind of hard to tell people to take their investment and go home, or we don't want your investment in the community when the people are willing to invest and willing to make things new. And students and renters seem to want new, nice product and up-to-date things and near downtowns.
We noted that the first of 2 citizen engagement meetings will be held Wednesday evening at the Hanna Community Center. Eric, what are you expecting to hear? How do you expect these citizen engagement meetings to affect the process?
Well, we take citizen input very seriously. I would hope for, a civil discourse about what are the options the citizens want to hear about? Because obviously our group, you know, we're trying to be very informed and trying to understand the options. But, you know, the citizens are the ultimate, you know, owners of the city. So they need to speak and have their voice heard and give us ideas of how they need to move forward. Because ultimately they're the ones with their elected officials that make the ultimate decisions.
We want to thank both of our guests. Dr. Eric Scorsone directs the MSU Extension Center for Local Government and Finance and Policy. He's also a member of the East Lansing Financial Health Team. George Lahanis is the city manager for the city of East Lansing. Best of luck. We'll stay in touch on this process.
Thank you.
Hope to have you back. Well, this past week was a tough one for sports fans across the globe. Not only was Muhammad Ali laid to rest on Friday, but news broke that same day that Gordie Howe, one of the NHL's greatest players and probably the greatest Detroit Red Wing ever, had also died. Howe was 88 years old. Al Martin, host of WKAR's Current Sports, held two tributes late last week on our airwaves for the two sports heavyweights. Al's here to talk about that, as well as pro baseball dreams for a few MSU Spartans. Good to see you, Al.
How you doing, Mark? And before we move forward, though, I want to tell our listeners we do have breaking news. This news just came through this hour, and bit of uncanny news, you know, that we're having a discussion about Muhammad Ali and Gordie Howe. Of course, two deaths that happened last week. But breaking news this morning, legendary former Michigan State hockey head coach and athletic director Ron Mason has passed away.
Oh, my goodness.
He was 76 years old. Of course, Mason led the Spartans to the 1986 NCAA National Championship, was the winningest college hockey coach when he retired from coaching in 2002. And, of course, he served as Michigan State's AD from 2002 up until 2007. And he was inducted into the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame in 2013. And it has been announced that Tom Onassis, head coach of the Michigan State hockey team right now, he will hold a press conference at Munn Ice Arena at 11 a.m. So some sad local news, Mark. It seems as though every day every week I feel like we're losing a legend in the sporting world.
This one really hits close to home. He was a beloved and respected guy that I spoke with many times over the years. So Ron Mason passing away at the age of 76. I imagine you'll be covering this on Current Sports.
Certainly. I plan on being in the house when Tom makes comments at 11, and we hope to have Tom. Going to see if we can get him on Current Sports this afternoon. So, but we did two tribute shows last week, Mark, one for Ali, and of course on Friday, one for Gordie Howe, and now we're looking at a third. I can't believe it. Really can't believe it.
Do we have a cause of death here?
We don't. Now? We don't. Okay. It's a breaking story. So, this just came through. I saw it about 30 minutes ago. So, it's a breaking news story right now. Michigan Hockey Now first reported it, and they're still gathering details.
Okay. Well, let's revisit some of the activity that you had on Current Sports last week to pay tribute to Muhammad Ali and Gordie Howe. Who'd you have on the program?
Well, it was an interesting week. You know, Monday we brought on Ali Easley, who's a head boxing trainer at Crown Boxing in Lansing, Michigan, who is absolutely fantastic. And we brought Ali on really to talk about Ali's effect in the world of boxing, just specifically when it comes to our youth today and how much they know about Ali. So he was a great, great guest and a fitting name, right? Ali Easley, right? Mm-hmm. Also, we had on Rob South, formerly of WKAR, who actually did an interview sync with Muhammad Ali when he was here at WKAR. So he told a very cool story where he got to visit Ali's residence out in Berrien Springs, Michigan. Also, Bob Every, chairman of the Greater Lansing Sports Hall of Fame and Hall of Fame boxer in his own right. And our very own Scott Pohl. Not only did he join us on Current State that Monday, but I had to bring him on that afternoon to retell that story of meeting Ali at the airport. And on Friday, the tribute show for Gordie Howe, we invited Richard Kincaid, Detroit sports broadcaster and author, and Tom Newton, MSU hockey assistant coach. And if you guys want to check out those two tribute shows, just simply visit WKAR.org.
Where do you think Gordie Howe ranks in terms of the broader hockey landscape?
I think the general consensus when you discuss the impact of Gordie Howe is that he is the best or the second best hockey player of all time. You hear two names when you have this discussion,
Gretzky,
right?
Sure.
Wayne Gretzky and Gordie Howe. And you know, you look at, you know, Gordie Howe's career, really unbelievable. Now, I know I'm always big on, you know, this old adage of comparing eras in the world of sports. No one's going to be right when you compare eras. You know what I mean, Mark? You
exactly.
know, if you look at the game was so different back when Howe played than it was for Gretzky. You know, when Howe broke into the NHL back in 1946, there was just, the original six teams. That was it. I mean, when Gretzky got into the league, I mean, we're talking about 21-plus teams here. So it's such a different era, but those are the two names you bring up constantly. And I think the old hockey heads would put Howe above Gretzky.
Mm. What are the burial plans here? What is scheduled here for Gordie Howe?
Yeah, so visitation will be open to the public tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. at the Joe, at Joe Louis Arena, you know, honoring Howe's iconic sweater number while allowing fans to pay their respects to Mr. Hockey and the Howe family. The funeral service will take place at 11 a.m. on Wednesday at the Cathedral of the Most Blessed Sacrament. That address is 9844 Woodward Avenue in Detroit. And Howe, it's being stated that Howe will be cremated just as his wife was, Colleen, who passed away back in 2009.
Well, on to more brighter news here. The Major League Baseball draft took place over the weekend. There were a few players taken from the Michigan State team. Who are we talking about here?
Yes, we had four Spartans taken this past weekend in the Major League Baseball draft. We had Cam View. He was taken by Pittsburgh in the sixth round, 195th pick overall. Jordan Zimmermann, he went to the LA Angels, seventh round, 216 overall. Dakota Meeks of the Chicago Cubs, 10th round, 314th overall, and Matt Byers, Minnesota, 24th round, 723rd overall. And I will say this, it's even though they were drafted, doesn't mean they're going straight to the league. They do have until July 15th to decide whether to turn pro this summer or return to Michigan State in the fall.
Which of those four is most MLB ready, would you say?
For me, Mark, I got to go with Cam View. He went 7-4 this past year, had a 2.28 ERA, 77 strikeouts over 87 innings so far for this season, I should say, for the Spartans. And, you know, he's 6'4", 203-pounder. His body is certainly ready for the grit and grime of a long MLB year. And if you look at, you know, View's career, though, a year ago, the Detroit Tigers took him in the 19th round with the 580th pick after his redshirt sophomore season, and he opted to return to school instead of signing, which I thought was a great decision, seeing as though where his draft stock is now in the sixth round. But for me, when you look at those four players, I think Cam View can really make an impact off the bat.
With the players that the team, the Spartans have lost, what kind of success, what level of success do you anticipate for the Spartan baseball team next year?
Well, Jake Boss, you know, Jr., has done a great job with this program. If you look at this team last year, Mark, I mean, they went 12-1 to start the season. That was the best start in program history. They moved the 2016 team past the 1946, 1971, and 1992 clubs that started 11-2 for the best record through 13 games in school history. So when you talk about that kind of a start, coupled with the fact that this is a pretty young team, sky's the limit. And, you know, Jake Boss Jr., he's done a great job ever since he's been at the helm of this squad. So, hey, I expect, you know, success for this team next year. Even though they missed the NCAAs, just missed the NCAAs this past year, the squad is in good hands.
We opened up this segment with some breaking news. It's safe to say it's not that often that we have breaking news here on Current State, but you share that with us. Today will be kind of a grim day here in East Lansing, certainly on the campus of Michigan State, but throughout the state as well, with the passing again of former MSU hockey coach and athletic director Ron Mason at the age of 76. Surprising news. Did you rub shoulders with Ron Mason much here,
you know,
here in Lansing?
I didn't, Mark. You know, when I would see Ron, it was, you know, just from a distance. I never had a one-on-one interaction with him. I know he would come back frequently to Michigan State and visit with the program. And, you know, his influence is directly felt in the athletic program, and here just in mid-Michigan. He was such a prominent figure here, you know, holding the position of athletic director, not just as head coach, and he had so many accolades. But I really wish I did, Mark. I can't say that, though.
You missed a great interview.
Definitely.
I interviewed him a number of times here over the years, and he was respected, but at the same time, there's a great deal of affection for
you
the
hear that.
Guy.
Very
he
down to earth is what you
very likable guy.
Yeah.
Well, Al, we want to thank you. More here on the death of Ron Mason and other sports news coming up with Al Martin's Current Sports coming up 1 p.m. every weekday on AM 870. Don't forget Current Sports TV Thursday night at 10:30 on WKAR-TV. Thank you, Al.
Hey, thank you, Mark.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, Michigan's moose population is on the decline. That's prompting the federal government to consider extending the animal additional protections under the Endangered Species Act. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is studying the problem and inviting public comment. We'll talk with Drew Youngdyke about the issue with the Michigan United Conservation Clubs. Plus, we'll stroll down the Lansing Street where newspaper kiosks have been turned into an art exhibition. Learn more about the Lansing Art Gallery's pop-up art special edition installation. That and more Tuesday. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Thanks to Kevin Lavery, who directed our show today, as well as to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and technician Isaac Constance. Have a great day. We'll be looking for you Tuesday on Current State.